church. It's good to see y'all. Good to be together as always, but it's especially good to be together with people you love and people you get you're walking daily with in the light of God's Word. I miss our small groups already. I'm looking forward. We're working towards trying to get those back up and running again for this fall. And I'm going ahead and just get an early encouragement for you to consider doing that. It has been a busy summer for many of us. I know we're missing several this morning. We've got some back and we've got some more out, but it's good to have those of you who are back. Good to have you here with us. Now, we've been studying for the last few weeks. We've been going through our kind of a discipleship kind of thinking about our lives in a way that examines the different facets of it and seeing how it relates to our relationship with Christ. Now, last week we talked a little bit about time, and especially we talked about where we needed to go for refreshment, how a Sabbath rest was important. And I was thankful I got to spend some time with some of you this week just doing that, just spending time together and talking about all sorts of different things and just relaxing and being together. I think that's really an important facet of our walk with Christ, that we need that downtime. And we need that downtime together. We need that downtime alone as well. This week, I want to shift focus just a little bit as we continue on this discipleship series, that these other attitudes that affect our relationship with God. You may have heard of Stockholm Syndrome. If you've heard of that, raise your hand. Have you ever heard of Stockholm Syndrome? Well, Stockholm Syndrome is a psychological phenomenon, and it was named... was brought up to the world's attention following a 1973 attempted bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden. Now, this man tried to rob a bank, and the police closed in on him pretty quickly. So he took three female hostages, one male hostage, and he held them for 131 hours. Now, during that time, he terrorized these people. He had this Russian make assault rifle that he would repeatedly fire in their general direction. He placed a noose around their necks and threatened to hang them. He did it all, but he never actually harmed them. I mean, he never actually shot them, never actually killed anyone. And when this man, this violent, abusive criminal, finally surrendered, something unusual happened. You know, because you would expect that these hostages would be, hostile to their hostage taker from this man who had put them through just a nightmare for the last 131 hours. Instead, these four people, reported that they feared the police more than they feared their hostage taker. Not only did they not hate their captor, they actually refused to testify against him in court. Court case rolled around. The four key witnesses refused to testify. One of those ladies actually became engaged to their hostage taker. And apparently this is not just a unique event. It's happened before and has happened since. So psychologists say that in a hostage situation with a high level of life-threatening stress, that people begin to deny what's actually happening to them, and they enter into this different emotional state. And the hostage will eventually begin to transfer their fear and their hatred to something beyond their situation, something that threatens their current situation. And then something else happens, a love relationship begins to form. A relationship that's strangely akin to a mother-child relationship. Because the hostage will begin to look to their captor for safety, for protection, for providence, for all of their needs. And the hostage taker sort of does those things, right? Make sure that no one else hurts their hostages. Make sure that they're the ones who provide for the needs. And this love relationship forms, which is hard to believe. Like from you and I, outside looking in, I don't know anyone who has physically actually been a hostage or in that type of situation. These people, though, they start seeking safety and provision
from the one person, the one thing that most threatens it. Does that make any sense? Like the one thing that threatens their safety the most, that's who they look to for safety. The one thing that threatens their stability, their providence the most, that's who they look to for it. The real tragedy of Stockholm Syndrome is that hostages gradually replaced with a love for the very enemy that enslaves them. Their fear of their hostage taker is replaced by a love for the very enemy that enslaves them. And again, I don't know anyone who's actually been in this situation. You may or may not, but someone who's technically been taken a hostage. But I do know some people who struggle with something pretty similar. People who have come to love the very thing that enslaves them. It could be an addiction. It could be a habit. But you come to love the very thing that threatens you the most. And Jesus met some people who were kind of like this during his time on earth. And he tried to show them how empty their way of life was, how dead-end that sort of philosophy was. And they didn't seem to get it. I mean, if you've ever tried to talk to an addict about their addiction, you can kind of see it's often a one-way discussion until that person's willing to listen, right? So one of Jesus' encounters with a person like this is recorded in the book of Luke, chapter 12, and it goes like this. So someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Which seems like an odd response because really we're told Jesus is a judge, right? Jesus is like, "God appointed me a judge." But what's going on here, I've heard a lot of people say that they wish they could have met Jesus, right? I wished I could have been back then. I could have listened to him teach, watched him walk around, seen him perform the miracles. I wished I could have been there. And I have even thought that myself many times. But here's the thing. This guy's there. I mean, he is seeing the man who brings life to all of creation. He's seeing the face of the Creator, in a sense. And he's standing here in the presence of the Son of God. In his mind, the most important thing is, I got to get my money. Does that make sense? Now, on the surface here, it's all about fairness and equality. All I want is my fair share, and I need somebody with some muscle, some power, some authority to do that for me. Some younger brother, he's upset that his older brother, who gets the lion's share of the inheritance, but he's not doling it out fairly to him, right? The older brother's supposed to get the most, but he's supposed to divide it up fairly among the other siblings, the other brothers. And so he's mad that his inheritance wasn't being given out in a fair manner. And we don't know if it was or it wasn't. It could be entirely a legitimate claim. His older brother could have been being selfish. But Jesus never stays on that surface issue, at least not for very long. Instead, he goes right to the heart of the problem, and this is what he says in verse 15. "Watch out. Be on guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." He said the real problem for this man who comes to Jesus, the real problem is not that he's not getting his fair share. Now, that's what he thinks the real problem is that I'm not getting as much as I deserve. And maybe you know people like this. Maybe they work at a job they feel like they're better than, or maybe they feel like they're undervalued as an employee, or maybe they feel like that life has just dealt them a bad hand, that they deserve so much better, a better spouse maybe, or a better home, or a better living circumstances, but it feels like the world is out there. So they want that justice. They want things to be fair for them. And that's what this guy thinks is going on. But the real problem is not that surface issue. The real problem was that he thought, if I get this fairness, that somehow it's going to make me complete, make me content. If only I could get X, I would be all right with the world. Right? If only my boss could see my potential, then everything would be all right. If only my wife or my husband saw how much I really do around here, then everything would be all right. If only I had X amount of dollars in the bank, everything would be all right. If only. And that's what this guy is thinking. And Jesus says, even if you had it, you wouldn't have life. Even if you had an abundance of possessions, that wouldn't give you life. That's not going to make you complete. That's not going to make you content. That's not going to make you fulfilled. Covetousness is one of those underserved, over-religiousized words. It's a word that, and we kind of short sell that one. When it comes to the Ten Commandments, that one often gets short shrift. I mean, those other stuff sounds pretty important, but just like, hey, I like your new car. I wish I had one like that. Doesn't sound so bad. Right? That doesn't sound like it's on the par with murder or lying or stealing or breaking the Sabbath. Right? Covetousness just sounds like a pretty small thing. So we often don't take it very seriously, as if it weren't really a sin on the scale with the other nine commandments. But Jesus is saying that going around wanting more things all the time, that will suck the life out of you. Going around wanting more things all the time is not life-giving. Life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. Now, if we had to put a definition on covetousness this morning, we might just say it's craving more than what you have already. I mean, that's just a real rough, real broad definition. It's seeing what you don't have and thinking that's what you got to have, right? The problem is that enough is never enough. Because no matter what it is, if it's the car or the house or the money or the spouse or the job, whatever it is, when you get it, you're not fulfilled. There's this financial guru, and his name's Ken Roberts, and he said that when he began building his fortune, he thought that if he had $1 million, that would be the magic number. Like, if I could just get $1 million, I would be set, right? That'd be all. I could eliminate all of my worries. I wouldn't have to worry about anything if I just had $1 million. But then he became a millionaire. And then he realized that $1 million was not a magic number. There's still plenty of problems with $1 million. So he said it needed to be five. And he got $5 million. Through his business dealings, he earned $5 million. Then he realized, no, there's a lot of problems when you have $5 million. What I need is $10 million. And he got $10 million. And this cycle just kept going and going and going. And after years of wealth building and accumulation, he finally came to the realization, duh, there is not a magic amount. No matter what I've got in the bank, it's never enough. That his peace of mind would have to come from something other than his bank account. Now, unfortunately, many of us never get to hit that wall. We may have a number in our head, and we never get to that number. And so we just think, well, that number's just going to elude me. Thus, peace and contentment and happiness is going to elude me. And it's a message that comes to us that in like thousands of seductive voices. It's the message of our country and our century that life does indeed consist of things. You can see it on 100 billboards between here and Nashville. You can see it on the messages of the sponsors of this radio program or on this television program. It's sung to you in jingles on the radio. It's blared to you on the newspapers and in the internet and comes to you, your email inbox, and shows up alongside your Facebook page. But what it promises, that peace, that contentment, that happiness, that fulfillment, what it promises, it can never, ever deliver. What possessions promise, they cannot deliver. There is no question that we live in a materialistic society. And I would go beyond that, say not just materialistic, because we're not just about getting more stuff. We need the newest stuff, right? It's consumeristic. It's not important that I own it. It's important that I buy it. And so there's no question that we live in that sort of society and that money is the driving force behind what happens in a lot of our daily lives. I mean, that's just goes without saying.
King Solomon was credited with being one of the wisest man to ever live. But I wonder how long it took him to sort of arrive at the truth of his own words. Because you see his life, and sometimes his life doesn't match up to his wisdom. But this is what he said in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And this is the Living Bible version. I like this. It kind of puts it in plain words. He says, those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness. The more you have, the more people come to help you spend it. So what good is wealth except to perhaps to watch it slip through your fingers? And then a little bit later, he said this, it's better to see what you have than to want more. Wanting more, that covetousness we talk about, is useless, like chasing the wind. And what Solomon is saying here, it goes against everything we've ever been taught about money or possessions. It goes against the economics classes you've taken, and it goes against basic math, because more is more in math. This goes against the psychological reasoning that if I have more, I'll have more security. It goes against everything. It goes against all those principles. He was saying, though, that the wealthiest person was not the person with the greatest number of possessions, that the wealthiest person was the one who saw the value in what they already had. So you don't have the car or the house. So you don't have that job or don't have that spouse or those number of kids or whatever it is you think you want. What's the value of what you already have been given? How contrary is that to the messages that are emblazoned on the very fabric of our nation? What's the American dream? Anybody remember how the American dream is not just like get here and get freedom, right? The American dream is get here, get freedom, get a job, get some money, build a life, right? That's the American dream, to own your own house, to own your own car, to make a success out of nothing. That's the American dream. And by the way we define success always entails finances on some level. We never see someone who's got like a great marriage and great kids who's dead broke and says, boy, that dude's a success. No companies use those people as their advertising agents. Success means money. Making more money so that you can have more and better things, right? We admire progress in our society. There's a big national corporation that tells us progress is its most important product. The only trouble is that most of our progress is not made in people. It's made in things. That's, again, another pseudonym. Progress is another pseudonym for materialism. It's not really progress, though, if you're making rapid progress down the wrong road. I'm not really going anywhere important, but I'm getting there in a hurry, right? Years ago, there was this missionary in Africa. His name was Dan Crawford. And he was coming back from Africa to the United States for a time. And to do so, he had to leave the inner part of the country. This was years ago, before the infrastructure that even today Central Africa has was in place. And so he was having to walk from the inland to the coast so he could catch his ship. And so that he wouldn't have to make his trip alone, there were these four African brothers who were walking with him. They were to keep him company, keep him safe, all that. And so as Crawford is walking along, he's talking to his friends about the glories of the coast when they finally see the cities, right? He told them about the lights that didn't have a flame. He talked to them about the wagons that did not have animals. He talked to them about storing their food so that it would not spoil. He talked to them about all those things. And as he walked and talked, three of those men really got into the conversation. But the fourth man was just almost completely silent, strangely silent. And after a few days, they were sitting there one evening, and Crawford found it irritating that this one guy wasn't like getting excited about all this. And he said to him, you know, aren't you eager to get there? Aren't you excited to see the city and see all those things? And that African brother responded with a wisdom that I thought was particularly apropos to our situation. He said, Mr. Crawford, To be better off is not to be better. Having things, no matter how many or how great the quantity or the quality, will never have anything to do with our satisfaction in life. On one occasion, Jesus was approached by a man who had a desire to follow him. And Jesus said to him that he, you know, I know you want to be my disciple. And Jesus' response was, foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Now let's just stop and think about that for just a moment. Because if things really made life better, and if Jesus came to give us life, why didn't he have stuff? If things really made life better, and Jesus came so that you and I could have life to the full, to the fullest, then why didn't he give us an example of having stuff? I think that sometimes we get caught up in our own culture sometimes. And no matter how many times or how many effective ways this message is communicated, Jesus' words will always be that life is not about things. In a lot of ways, you could say our life's kind of like a game of chess. People have often compared it to that. There's all sorts of different pieces in the games of chess. They have different power, different maneuverability. But when the game is all over, no matter what you've done with those pieces, they all get put back in the box. And that game is kind of like our lives. You can play the game. You can play against the system. The system may beat you, or you may beat the system. You may capture some. You may be captured by others. But the reality is that in the end, the game is eventually over, and it always comes to an end. And I just can't fathom any of us that when our lives are over, when we face our own mortality, we're standing at the end of our lives, we're reflecting fondly on the wonderful possessions we've had. I can't imagine thinking, oh, man, really wished I'd polished my car one more time, right? Really wished I'd gotten that new grill for my teeth, not me, right? I can't imagine wishing that I had somehow gotten the luxury model of that one automobile I owned, or I'd bought a house with another 100 square feet, right? When we live for things, we know that we lose the joy of living. We stop possessing our possessions and they come to possess us. When we live for those things, we no longer own them. They own us. We stop having possessions and we start being possessed. So this morning, I want to encourage you. Spend your time, spend your money, spend your energy on the things that really matter. Live life for the things that really matter. And those things aren't really things. Now, this is not a sermon for you to go and sell all you own and give it to the preacher. Though if you want to do that, that is welcome. You're not going to take checks or money orders. That's not what this sermon is about. But rather that we shift our focus on the importance. I think once we shift our focus to what's really important, those things sort of drift by the wayside. Maybe we will own less, or maybe we'll stop consuming our time and energy with those new things. But the really important things are your relationships. They're your relationships with your family, with your friends. They're your relationships with your coworkers and your neighbors. And all of those relationships are empowered by and directed by your relationship with Christ, who is over all and through all and in all. That is what is important. And when we spend our time, we spend our money, we spend our energy on those important things, then things sort of fall away. This morning, if we can offer you encouragement, if you need strength, if you need forgiveness, if you are ready to become a child of God, if there's any way we can help you this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?